Welcome to this deep dive, where we dig into a fascinating mix of articles you've sent our way and, well, pull out the really interesting bits. Today, your curiosity has pointed us towards a real tech mix. Everything from making 3D drawings yourself,
right,
to how early computers first started talking to each other, and even a homemade gadget someone built to track their car's fuel use. Pretty varied stuff.
Exactly. We've got these great pieces from the Armasoft website. They're titled Third Ticket in Technique, Communicati Technique, Computer Technique, and Tor and Teller Technique.
Okay.
And what's really interesting, I think, is how these areas, which seem quite different on the surface,
yeah,
actually connect and build on each other within, you know, the broader world of technology. So our mission today is basically to explore the core ideas in each and maybe find some surprising insights.
Okay, sounds good. Let's start with that 3D drawing piece, Third Tekken and Technique. It sounds maybe a bit intimidating, but the article suggests it's becoming much more accessible.
It really is. That's a key point, this sort of democratization of visual creation. Tools like Blender, which is free, and Google SketchUp are mentioned as great starting points.
Right, so you don't need to be a full-on professional designer anymore.
Not at all. I mean, professional software is still complex, of course, but these tools put powerful 3D modeling within reach for almost anyone.
The article mentions the interfaces are often in English, which might be a hurdle for some.
True. But it also points out that Dutch tutorials are available, which is helpful.
And it's not something you learn in 5 minutes, is it? It suggests, what, about 30 hours to get reasonably good?
Yeah, around 30 hours, which, okay, it's a time investment, but it feels doable, you know?
Definitely. And I liked their advice on how to learn. Basically, learn by doing. Try to recreate things.
Mm-hmm.
They even suggest starting with something like a classic chair with all the curves and spindles and legs.
That hands-on approach is just so effective, isn't it? You're actively grappling with the challenges of 3D space, not just reading theory. It makes you figure things out.
Like learning a language by just trying to talk.
Exactly.
It also gets you thinking creatively. The article encourages you to think about personal projects, like maybe recreating your old school or your house.
Or even just designing your name in 3D letters, just for fun.
Yeah. And it acknowledges that you will get stuck sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's when you turn to things like YouTube tutorials to figure out the problem. I can definitely relate to that feeling of seeing something complex in 3D, making it click.
It's a natural learning curve, moving from simple shapes to understanding how real objects are constructed. The article also links this to professional CAD/CAM software.
Right. Computer-aided design, computer-aided manufacturing.
Yeah. And it positions SketchUp as a sort of more user-friendly version of that.
Mm.
And think about the detail involved if you try to recreate, say, a building digitally.
Oh, yeah.
You're not just drawing the outside walls. You need to think about the foundation depth, maybe basement levels, how thick the walls are, where the stairs go.
Cavity walls, fixtures, ornamentation. It's quite involved.
It really is. It's like being a digital architect or archaeologist.
And the practical tips they give for starting sound really helpful. Like, begin simple, flat plane, basic shapes.
Crucial. Don't try to build the Taj Mahal on day one.
And using groups and layers, that sounds essential for keeping things organized.
Absolutely vital. Imagine trying to adjust one window and accidentally moving the whole wall because everything's jumbled together.
Nightmare.
So separating things like floors, walls, even different rooms into layers or groups is key. It's like digital housekeeping.
And saving multiple versions. The classic save often rule, but also using paste in place if you need to go back and fix something.
It's your safety net. And the tip about working with straight angles first, then rotating later, that simplifies the initial construction immensely.
Makes sense. Build it flat, then tilt it up. And the lock command locking parts you don't want to accidentally change, that sounds like a real sanity saver.
Oh, it is. It stops you from those oops moments where you nudge something you'd already perfected.
These little tricks really make it feel less daunting, and you can see the practical uses, right? Designing a little playhouse or a garden shed.
Exactly. Visualizing it first.
Before you buy any wood. It underlines the value of good plans. And hey, if you can't find plans you like, maybe you could design your own with these tools.
That's the real power here, I think. These tools are, as we said, democratizing design and visualization, making complex things understandable and accessible.
Okay, let's completely switch gears now from the visual to the invisible, almost. Early computer communication.
Right, the article Communicati Technique.
It kicks off with a really fundamental statement. A computer that cannot communicate is worthless.
That hits home, doesn't it? We take communication for granted now, but it's always been the core purpose.
Yeah, you don't really think about it that way.
The article traces the evolution from just getting output onto a monitor or printer to computers talking to each other remotely, like over the internet or, you know, early networks and phone lines.
And to understand today's complex stuff, they take us right back to basics. A simple serial interface, the kind used for old teletype machines.
Exactly. It's foundational. How did computers first send information bit by bit down a single wire?
So how did it work? It sounds almost like Morse code for computers.
In a way, yes. At its heart, the computer's processor, the CPU, sends a byte that's 8 bits of data to a specific chip, a UART.
UART.
Universal Asynchronous Receiver Transmitter. Think of it as the computer's modem or translator. It takes the byte and prepares to send it out one bit after another.
Okay.
It starts by changing the voltage on the wire, dropping it to 0 volts. That's the start bit. It's like shouting, hey, listen up, data coming.
Gotcha. The starting gun.
Precisely. Then it sends the actual data bits, the ones and oses that make up the byte, as a sequence of high and low voltages. For example, the code 10110011 would be sent as a specific pattern of voltage changes.
And the speed it sends them at is the baud rate.
Exactly, the baud rate. Bits per second. The article uses the example of 110 baud, common for teletypes. That meant about 10 characters per second. Slow.
Wow, yeah. So each individual bit had a specific time slot.
A very specific duration. At 110 baud, each bit lasted about 10 milliseconds. After all the data bits are sent, there's a stop bit, usually a high voltage signal to say, okay, that's the end of this character.
And how did the machine on the other end know what was going on?
The receiving UART is just waiting, listening to the wire. When it detects that drop in voltage, the start bit, it knows to start paying attention.
Okay.
It then waits a specific amount of time to land in the middle of the first data bit's time slot and checks the voltage. Then it waits for the middle of the second bit slot, checks the voltage, and so on for all the data bits.
So timing is absolutely critical.
Absolutely critical. It has to sample the line at just the right moments based on the agreed upon baud rate. Then it looks for the stop bit to confirm the character is complete.
It's amazing to think how slow 110 baud is. You said 10 characters a second. Compared to gigabits per second now.
It's mind-boggling, isn't it?
Yeah.
The article notes that even just 20 years ago, that speed was considered acceptable for some things.
Incredible.
But here's the key insight. Even our super-fast, complex, modern communication protocols, USB, Ethernet, Wi-Fi, all of it, they're still fundamentally built on these basic principles. Sending synchronized sequences of signals, representing data, understanding this simple serial stuff helps you appreciate the logic underneath it all.
So our lightning-fast internet is basically just a hyper-accelerated version of this old teletype chatter.
In a very fundamental sense, yes. The core concepts of signaling, timing, and encoding data persist. It shows how complex tech often grows from simple, solid foundations.
Okay, let's move on to something a bit more personal feeling. The article, Computer Technique. This one takes us back to the late 70s.
Oh, nostalgia time.
Yeah. It mentions you could get things like electronic games just for opening a bank account back then.
Ah, yes. It shows how novel and exciting those first bits of electronic entertainment were.
Yeah.
A real incentive.
But those were often dedicated game devices, right? Limited.
Very limited. Which leads into the main focus. The Electrospiel computer project. This wasn't just a pong machine.
Right.
It was pitched as something more for calculations, maybe even music. The slogan was fantastic. The only limitation is your own imagination. Really capture that early hacker spirit.
And it wasn't like buying a PC today. You had to assemble it, didn't you? The article lists the components.
Oh, yeah. Microprocessor, video interface, plus a monitor, memory, a keyboard, even a cassette recorder for saving programs.
Cassette recorder, what?
That was your hard drive. And putting it together was part of the experience. The article mentions it used double-sided printed circuit boards, which was pretty sophisticated for a hobbyist project then.
And there's a personal note in the article, you actually built the keyboard for one of these with help from a colleague, WS.
That's right, yes. Good memory. We did. We even adapted an old tape recorder case to house it. You had to be resourceful back then.
That's brilliant. A real hands-on project.
It really was.
And programming, it wasn't like Python or JavaScript today, was it? The article talks about hexadecimal.
No higher languages here, generally. You were often programming directly in hexadecimal or even machine code. That meant communicating directly with the microprocessor chip itself, the Signetics 2650 in this case.
So you really had to understand the hardware at a deep level.
Absolutely. That's the key insight, I think. This direct interaction forced you to understand binary hexadecimal memory addressing, how the machine actually thought. It built a really fundamental understanding.
like learning engine mechanics instead of just driving. The article does a nice job explaining binary for people who might not know the ones and oses.
Mm-hmm. The basic building blocks, on or off.
And how they group into bytes, 8 bits. It uses the analogy of decimal counting, but based on powers of 2 instead of 10.
Right, and it introduces the nibble 4 bits.
To half a byte.
2 nibbles make a byte, giving you 256 possible combinations, 0 to 255. Then comes hexadecimal base 16.
Which uses 0 to 9, and then A, B, C, D, E, F for 10 through 15.
It's exactly. It sounds weird at first, but as the article explains, it's just a more compact, human-readable way to represent those binary patterns. Easier to write AD than 1001101.
It gives a specific example. Decimal 141 is binary 1001101, which is hex 8D. Makes sense when you see it laid out.
It does. Okay. And for the really keen, the article mentions a downloadable PDF, quite large actually, with deep details on how that Signetics 2650 processor works internally.
They even included a photo of a keyboard layout from 81. It looks so basic.
Very functional. And while you could play games on it, the article really stresses that the main value wasn't just playing Pong again.
Right.
It was designing your own games, doing calculations, figuring out how to make the microprocessor do what you wanted, learning its inner workings.
The combination of that relatively simple Signetics 2650 chip and the programmable video interface, PVI, made it a powerful learning tool, didn't it?
An excellent learning tool. It laid bare the fundamentals of computation fetching instructions, manipulating data, controlling hardware. Understanding that stuff gives you such a deep appreciation for the complexity and power hidden inside our modern devices.
Yeah, you look at your smartphone differently after thinking about this. Those core ideas are still in there, just massively evolved.
Absolutely. Instruction sets, memory management, input-output, the concepts are still relevant, just operating at vastly greater speeds and scales.
Okay, final article for this dive. Torrenteller technique. A tachometer.
Right, the rev counter in your car.
Most cars have one. Shows engine speed, RPM. But this article describes a homemade one from 1988.
Yes, designed for an old Ford Escort 1100. And the interesting part is why it was built.
Which was?
To get a really accurate measure of fuel consumption. Not just miles per gallon overall, but relating fuel use directly to engine revolutions.
Clever. So how did it work? It tapped into the car's ignition system.
That's the core principle. The ignition system creates an electrical pulse every time it fires a spark plug. That pulse goes through the ignition coil, the bobbin, as they call it.
Okay.
That pulse became the input signal. The article details the circuit they built to count these pulses.
Right. It mentions simulating the signal, then using a multivibrator.
Right.
Built with logic gates.
Yes. A flip-flop circuit acting as the core of a binary counter. This counter was designed to count up to 100 pulses.
And when it hit 100...
A NAND gate detected the count of 100 and triggered a transistor. This transistor did two things. It rapidly charged up a capacitor.
Storing energy?
Exactly. And it simultaneously reset the counter back to zero, ready for the next 100 pulses.
Okay, so the capacitor gets charged every 100 pulses. Then what?
That charged capacitor then discharges its energy through another transistor, and that transistor activates a relay.
A physical switch.
In this case, yes. An old telephone pulse meter scavenged for the job, clicking over each time the relay activated. That click represented 100 ignition pulses.
Huh. That's brilliant. Using old tech in a new way.
Very resourceful. The article notes the capacitor needed to be beefy enough to reliably trigger the relay's electromagnet. And there's a diode to protect the transistor from voltage spikes from the relay coil. Careful design.
And it clarifies that 100 ignition pulses actually means 50 crankshaft revolutions, right? Because of how the engine timing works.
Correct. Due to the camshaft running at half the crankshaft speed in a typical four-stroke engine. So each click of their counter meant 50 engine turns.
So the practical application was note the car's odometer, note their custom counter reading, fill the tank, drive, repeat.
Exactly. Track the mileage, track the clicks, each representing 50 revs, and track the fuel used between fill-ups.
And with that data, they could calculate things like crankshaft revolutions per liter of fuel.
Or, flipping it around, fuel consumed per revolution. They estimated about 50 microliters per revolution for that specific Ford Escort. Tiny amounts, but they add up.
And did it reveal anything interesting?
Oh, yes. Big differences in efficiency based on driving style and conditions. Winter city driving was terrible. Maybe 1 kilometer per liter, which is like 4 miles per gallon. Really bad.
Whoa.
Whereas steady highway driving at 100 kilometers might get them closer to 1 in 18 kilometers per liter, which is more like 42 miles per gallon. Huge difference for the same car.
So the homemade counter really gave them deep insight into how the car behaved.
That was the real value. Not just an average MPG number, but a feel for how driving habits impacted fuel use moment by moment, or at least trip by trip.
It's quite different from modern cars that just show you instantaneous fuel consumption on a screen.
Very different. This is much more involved. But the understanding gained by building it and collecting the data yourself must have been immense. You're really connecting with the mechanics.
It's impressive ingenuity, taking a common instrument and rebuilding it to learn something specific.
It really underscores the value of understanding the how and why behind the technology, even when modern versions offer more convenience. That deeper understanding is often lost.
So, quite a journey today. To wrap up this deep dive, we've touched on making 3D drawing accessible.
The democratization of design.
We looked at the absolute basics of how computers first communicated.
Those foundational serial principles.
Took a trip back to the pioneering days of home computing and hands-on learning.
Yeah, the imagination era.
And finished with a really clever DIY approach to understanding car fuel consumption.
A diverse set, but all showing that even complex tech has understandable roots.
Absolutely. It feels like peeling back layers. Lots of aha moments in these articles, I think.
Definitely. And maybe it leaves us and you listening with a final thought to mull over.
Oh.
We've seen how these core ideas representing things visually in 3D, communicating electronically, computation itself, and measuring the physical world, how they've evolved. Thinking about those fundamentals, representation, communication, computation, measurement, how do you anticipate they might fundamentally shift or evolve in the next few decades? What are the big changes coming down the line in those core areas?